today on Against the Grain. For over half a century, big oil and the plastics industry, through their trade associations and front groups, have sold the public the false idea that plastics are renewable. Recycling became the mantra of good ecological stewardship, embraced by the likes of city governments, school children, and environmental groups. Davis Allen lays out the mass marketing of a deception. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In a story reminiscent of deceptions by tobacco and opioid companies, for over 50 years, the plastics industry has been spinning a falsehood to consumers. That falsehood is that plastics can be recycled when most of them cannot. This effort by major petrochemicals companies, including Chevron Phillips, Dow, Exxon, Shell, and DuPont, often concealed behind trade associations like the American Plastics Council and the American Chemistry Council, has successfully sought to head off periodic public efforts to regulate and ban plastics. Joining me to discuss this history of duplicity is Davis Allen. He's an investigative researcher at the Center for Climate Integrity and the lead author of their report, The Fraud of Plastic Recycling, How Big Oil and the Plastics Industry Deceived the Public for Decades and Caused the Plastic Waste Crisis. Davis, can you speak to the magnitude of plastic pollution? Would you characterize it as one of the key ecological crises of our time?
The plastic waste crisis is certainly one of the most significant ecological issues we face. Obviously, climate change is well understood now as an existential threat in sort of its own category, right? But I do think that plastic waste will have far-reaching impacts. I think in particular, the way that plastic waste sort of touches all of our lives. We all come into contact with plastic constantly. Studies continue to show this over and over again, that we are constantly all coming into contact with microplastics, basically at all times. Microplastics are in all of our bodies. We don't fully understand some of the impact that plastics are having, but there's no going back from our plastics age.
Well, this question might be asking the obvious, but maybe not. What is plastic made of? But as you all flag in your report, there's not just one plastic.
Right. Yeah, plastic is a little bit of a misnomer. We often use the word plastics to try to capture the fact that plastic isn't one thing, but sort of a collection of materials that fit very particular use cases. So plastics are, synthetic polymers made from, the vast majority of the time, oil and gas, and designed to have very particular qualities to meet specific use cases. So that's why plastics are around us in so many different ways, is that they just take a huge variety of forms, right? We tend to think about most of the plastic we encounter and sort of knowingly think about often is packaging or the plastic keys on your keyboard or different things like that. But in reality, plastics are all around us and take a wide variety of forms.
What companies are the main producers of plastics and how much do they overlap with big oil?
There's a lot of overlap. We often kind of refer to the petrochemical industry as one thing. That means, the companies that are making plastics and chemicals derived from fossil fuels. But for many companies, the extraction of fossil fuels and the production of plastic is happening under one company. So companies like Exxon, Chevron Phillips, Shell are simultaneously large-scale producers of fossil fuels, the companies that are extracting the fossil fuels, and then also turning them into plastic resins. Then there are also petrochemical companies that don't extract the fossil fuels themselves, but acquire fossil fuels and turn them into those plastic resins that ultimately become plastic products.
Well, we're going to spend much of this hour talking about how the plastics industry has very actively promoted the idea of plastic recycling. But before we get there, can you tell us why most plastic is actually not recyclable?
With plastic recyclability, it really comes down to technical and economic limitations. We really have to understand both to fully understand why so little plastic is actually recyclable. So first, there are the technical limitations, which are namely the fact that plastic is a complex material, and as it is broken down, as it undergoes the process of mechanical recycling, basically, shredding plastic into small bits and then melting it down again, that process degrades the quality of plastics. And so there are basic sort of technical limitations. Basically, like, plastics fill very particular needs, fit very particular use qualities for particular products. And so most recycled resins aren't capable of filling those same needs. They don't have those same qualities that the original material made from fossil fuels has. So that's kind of the basic technical limitation. Then there are also significant economic limitations. Those really come down to the fact that for post-consumer waste, for products that have been in a consumer's hand, have been used, and then end up in the recycling bin, the process of collecting, sorting, cleaning, processing those plastics just makes it almost impossible to compete with so-called virgin resins, or the resins made from fossil fuels. And then together, basically, those things combine to make plastic recycling just not viable for the vast in the vast majority of cases. In general, the product that you end up having, the recycled resin, is of lower quality and more expensive than that virgin resin made from fossil fuels.
And even if you can get around those questions, what about the process of heating plastics to make them into new products? Does that release petrochemicals of some form into the air?
The process of making plastics the first time has all kinds of environmental and human health impacts. We see places like Louisiana where petrochemicals are concentrated, petrochemical production is concentrated, places like Houston, Texas. And in these places, there are, again, massive environmental and human health impacts. And so the process of recycling doesn't alleviate any of those problems, with the initial production of plastics, for sure.
So when did plastics become or start becoming ubiquitous in American products? And was disposable plastic the norm from the beginning?
It really wasn't. Plastics in different forms go back to the late 19th century. But really, over the course of the first half of the 20th century, you see the rise of plastic products in a variety of different forms. But disposable plastics really only began in the post-war period. So the 40s, 50s, and 60s saw an explosion in the amount of disposable single-use plastic products that the average person in the United States encountered in their day-to-day life. And that was really by design. The industry recognized, it definitely grew significantly in the pre-war years, but during World War II, the industry expanded really dramatically, and in an effort to continue to grow their markets for plastic, they recognized that disposables presented significant opportunity for growth. Durable plastic products, they might make them, and then a person would use them for an extended amount of time. But with disposables, obviously, if they're only being used once and then being thrown away, you get opportunities for, you know, constantly producing more and more plastic products.
Well, what made plastic so cheap that you could sell manufacturers disposable plastic? Is it because it was the byproduct of the petrochemical industry? What makes it all so cheap?
The economics of plastic production are pretty complicated, given that it is sort of a competing use for fossil fuels. While we think of fossil fuels as being burned for energy, this is technically a competing use. But at the same time, as we talked about, many of the same companies are involved. And so, originally plastic production often kind of was, the fossil fuels used in plastic production were coming from certain byproducts of other fossil fuel production processes. And so the economics have fluctuated significantly over, you know, the decades that plastics have been in widespread use. But pretty consistently, they've been relatively cheap compared to many other materials.
Well, you mentioned that really the ubiquity of consumer plastics didn't really take off until after World War II. And of course, World War II gave an enormous boost to the petrochemical industry and research and so on. In that post-war period, in the 1950s, when did Americans start expressing their discontent with the plastic waste that started building up at that time? And what form did that discontent take? What were people calling for?
I would say discontent about plastic waste in particular, we don't see as much until the 1960s and 1970s. There definitely was a lot of resistance pretty early on in the era of disposable plastics to just the entire idea of disposability. And we see this with other products as well. There was sort of a deep resistance to the idea that any product should be used once and then thrown away. The industry, a variety of industries really, sold consumers on convenience and basically convinced people that that convenience was worth the wastefulness inherent to disposable or single-use products. But there was a special level of resistance, I think, with plastic products, just because the industry had spent a long time convincing people that plastics were durable, were a sort of forever product. Initially, there had been a lot of resistance to the adoption of plastics for many products, and so the shift to promoting disposability, sort of challenged consumers' perceptions of plastic products. But it was very important for the industry to, emphasize that disposability and convince people. The editor of Modern Plastics in the 1960s talked about basically convincing consumers that plastics weren't too good to end up in the garbage. So that was sort of their challenge during that period. When it comes to resistance to plastic waste in particular, I think with the rise of more widespread environmental concern in the 1960s and 1970s, plastics became sort of a central issue with the waste problem, because they were very visible. They linger in the environment. It's very clear when plastic waste is around us, because unlike paper or some other materials, they just sort of persist in the environment in a different way.
Davis Allen is my guest. He's an investigative researcher at the Center for Climate Integrity. and he's the lead author of the report, The Fraud of Plastic Recycling, How Big Oil and the Plastics Industry Deceived the Public for Decades and Caused the Plastic Waste Crisis. We're discussing that today. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you write in The Fraud of Plastic Recycling about how even in the 1950s, when plastic had not accumulated in the environment in the way that it did, it had by the 1970s, when obviously there was the flowering of all sorts of ecological movements. But even then, there was a concern about dry cleaning bags. And after dozens of children suffocated in dry cleaning bags, and that was a moment where the plastic industry responded in a way that sort of set a template for later. Can you tell us about all of that and the change from an emphasis on plastics being a durable thing that you could keep, you know, using again and again, to actually a promotion by the plastics industry of using it and throwing it away?
The plastic bag crisis of 1959 marks a really significant turning point for the plastics industry as a whole. Just a few years before, companies like DuPont, who produced the plastic that turned into plastic dry cleaning bags, had promoted the reusability of those products. They had encouraged people to find creative ways to use that plastic bag that they got from the dry cleaners in a variety of ways after its original intended use. But after this large number of children suffocated on the bags in 1959, the industry was under an enormous amount of pressure, and it's really the industry as we talk about it didn't completely exist before that. That sort of crisis moment when there was a genuine threat to, you know, as far as the industry was concerned, of product bans, you know, of outright bans on plastic products that might lead to this kind of suffocation risk. The industry sort of consolidated in that moment, and the Society of the Plastics Industry, which was a trade organization that had been around for decades at that point, took on a vital role in protecting the industry. So they launched a massive PR campaign, which basically involved shifting the blame to parents, specifically mothers, of the children who had died, saying, you're not supposed to, you know, continue using these products. You're meant to destroy them, tear them up, throw them away. So it presented this moment where really the interests of the industry on disposability and the interests of protecting the industry from bans shifted and began to align in a very clear way. And the Society of the Plastics Industry really led the charge in protecting the industry against those bans, but also encouraging disposability at the same time.
So then, as you had mentioned earlier, come the 1970s, the 1960s, an environmental movement starts taking shape that is pushing back on a whole variety of fronts, but one is to do with plastic waste. What did that look like in the 1970s?
It's really interesting because when we look at this period, the industry was really pretty unprepared for this kind of environmental backlash against plastic waste. As far as I can tell, the industry not only hadn't really considered recycling prior to 1970, they hadn't really considered the problem of plastic waste at all. There really was not much emphasis on disposal at all. You know, there was no real consideration of what happened to a plastic product, even a disposable or single-use plastic product, after its use. But around 1970, it really became clear that there were major problems associated with plastic waste. You know, that people in the 70s began to see a buildup of solid waste generally, and there was, increased concern about that issue, and plastic really became kind of a focal point for that concern. Again, I think because of its visibility and because seeing such a durable product be used once and then thrown away in so many cases, just sort of put a target on plastic. So then that backlash in the 1960s and especially 1970s really forced the industry to begin considering how to push back against that. In the early days of that, they really pushed landfilling and incineration, but found that those answers weren't really viewed as answers by the public. And so, yeah, throughout the 70s, the industry really grappled with that backlash and spent a lot of effort trying to figure out how they could effectively respond.
And how endangered were they in that period, in the 1970s and let's say into the 1980s, in terms of regulation to actually rein in plastics or even ban them?
Yeah, it seems like definitely there were some real threats beginning in the 70s. They were not as widespread then, but by the time you get into the 80s, the legislative threat to the industry was very real. And I think, you know, in some ways, as I was doing this project, I was sort of trying to figure out how real was that threat, you know, what were the chances that plastics actually may have been fundamentally impacted by this legislation? And I think that threat was very genuine. You know, I think that it's clear looking at industry documents from the time that there was an enormous amount of concern, not just about sort of the loss of you know, small markets, but there was concern about a widespread impact on the plastics industry and kind of an understanding that what may begin as a localized ban on a particular product could very easily spread into much more widespread limitations on plastic use, especially for disposables and single-use plastics, which, again, the industry had come to depend on so much. It was such a vital market for them, and it remains a vital market today. So, yeah, by the 80s, that threat was very real and was viewed as such by the industry itself.
So tell us about the ways that the industry then, in a number of different forms, went on the offensive to protect plastics and to promote plastic recycling. I wonder if you can start by talking about the use of front groups, often not directly backed by the plastics companies, but instead through the sort of middlemen of their trade associations, obscuring the connection.
Right. So, yeah, the actual campaign to promote recycling or to promote the idea that plastics were widely recyclable takes a wide variety of forms. But most of that, the actual work of convincing people that recycling was viable, that plastic recycling was viable, was accomplished through the efforts of trade organizations. So in general, the basic structure here is that, you know, trade organizations would represent either the plastics industry in its entirety or particular segments of the plastics industry. Many of those trade organizations launched campaigns to promote plastic recycling on their own and under their own names. But there's also a general understanding among industry groups that the public is pretty distrustful of, you know, whatever an industry is saying about itself. We see this across, you know, a wide variety of industries. This is always sort of a problem that they recognize. And so in this case, The plastics industry, you know, especially when it came to recycling, really understood that, you know, something under the name of the Society of the Plastics Industry, for example, could only carry so much weight in terms of influencing consumer belief about recycling. And so they created sort of a proliferation of front groups. Many of them housed under the Society of the Plastics Industry, but also many, you know, created by other trade organizations that did represent smaller segments of the industry. And ultimately, it was often those front groups which were directly funded basically by the petrochemical companies, and often, you know, directly influenced by the petrochemical companies. But it was those front groups that actually put into practice the widespread campaign to promote recycling.
And what did that campaign look like? How did they disseminate the position that recycling was not only viable, but a public good?
Yeah, it took a wide variety of forms. So one of the forms that we're all most familiar with is advertising. You know, there were a lot of advertisements coming from trade organizations and front groups that made, you know, very bold claims about the viability of plastic recycling. You know, they took a variety of forms. Sometimes it was very specific claims, like the idea that a bottle could come back as a bottle over and over again. In other cases, it was directly challenging the criticism of plastic recycling. You know, there would be advertisements that would sort of make fun of the idea that plastics weren't widely recyclable in an effort to discredit, you know, any criticism. The industry also created what are known as sponsored educational materials. So those are basically, you know, any materials that are used or designed to be used in schools for children. So, you know, I think anybody under a certain age, you know, anybody who was in school beginning in the mid-80s to mid-90s probably remembers encountering lots of materials in school that discussed the importance of recycling and connecting recycling to broader environmental issues. And many of those materials were created by either petrochemical companies or the trade organizations, often in an effort to conflate plastic recycling with the recycling of other materials that can be more widely recycled. That was really the goal with a lot of those materials, is making it seem like plastics could be recycled in the same way that, say, aluminum can be. There were also efforts to convince often like different audiences of the plastics industry's commitment to making recycling work. So even among audiences that knew that recycling wasn't working on a wide scale at the time, you know, the industry would set up recycling companies or build recycling facilities in their own name, and, you know, basically heavily publicize their investment in those facilities, knowing that they, you know, weren't really going to last, but would basically use the investment in those facilities to convince legislators, for example, or other decision makers that, you know, they actually were committed to solving the problem and basically just convincing them to hold off on enacting any bans or recycling legislation. And you know, then when the pressure died down, their investment in those facilities dissipated. So,
well, there are parallels between what the plastics industry has done about the false promise of recycling and promoting it and big tobacco. And I wonder if you found in your research about this history if the plastics industry played a role partnering with academic institutions into research on recycling or other forms of, in effect, legitimizing the promotions of the plastics industry.
Yeah, they did. The first and sort of most notable example of that was at Rutgers University. It was called the Center for Plastics Recycling Research, and it was created in the mid-80s. It was basically funded with a few steps in between by those petrochemical companies, by the resin producers. Did a lot of investment that the industry pointed to in a lot of materials, whether, you know, designed for the public or for legislators or, you know, any other audience. They would point to these investments and point to the progress that was being made on research related to plastic recycling at this Rutgers Center. In reality, most of that research was, you know, very limited in terms of practical impact, which is kind of acknowledged in internal industry documents. You know, one of the main areas of research at Rutgers, at this Center for Plastics Recycling Research, was the creation of those plastic benches that you'll see around sometimes, basically taking mixed plastics that aren't good for anything else and kind of melting them down and turning them into, you know, a fake wood that could then be used for benches. Yeah, that's not something that had a whole lot of... it's not something that got people too excited. You know, it has limited impact in terms of actually addressing plastic waste, but it was kind of, you know, something that could be pointed to. Some, basically, they were really desperate to find some use for mixed plastic waste in particular. There's just such limited use cases for that, yeah, a lot of that research went to sort of specific issues to give the industry something to point to, where previously they basically had no solution that they could even suggest.
To what degree do you feel like the environmental movement in the United States in the 1980s, in the 1990s, was swayed by the promotion of the plastics industry that plastic could be recycled?
I think very significantly. You know, I think in some ways the widespread promotion of recycling, including plastics recycling, by environmental groups and environmentalists writ large, I think that points to the success of the industry's campaign, really. Like I said, people are very distrustful of what an industry is saying about itself. And I think what we see in the effectiveness of this campaign is really how effective the industry was at making plastic recycling seem like a real answer to much more widespread environmental problems, linking plastic recycling to all kinds of other environmental issues that it's not really connected to, and to, you know, recycling more broadly. Again, kind of as we talked about, the conflation of plastics recycling and recycling of other materials like aluminum, paper, glass, cardboard. That campaign was so effective that I think even audiences who would be much more skeptical of what industry was saying believed it and kind of adopted it as a cause themselves.
I'm speaking with Davis Allen. He's investigative researcher at the Center for Climate Integrity, and we're discussing the report that he authored, or was the lead author for, titled The Fraud of Plastic Recycling, How Big Oil and the Plastics Industry Deceived the Public for Decades and Caused the Plastic Waste Crisis. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been describing the history of the ubiquity of plastic waste and then, in effect, the kind of public upswell that has happened periodically against it and the way that the plastics industry has responded to divert people's attention, especially through campaigning around the idea that plastic can be recycled and that this is a good thing. In that history, you know, you were talking about sort of the defensiveness of the industry in the 1980s against threats, regulatory threats, and the threats of social movements, and the kind of spin that the industry, its trade associations, its front groups set in motion in that period into the 90s and into the early 2000s, and that public pressure then subsided during that period. What did the industry do when it was under less scrutiny, especially around its sort of high-profile commitments to investment in facilities that would help recycle, make recycling much more viable or widespread? What happened in that period?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, the backlash definitely died down to some degree and definitely took different forms. And I think the forms that it took speak to the success of the plastic recycling myth, basically, you know, the effectiveness of their campaign to convince people that recycling was more, you know, that plastic recycling was more viable than it actually was. What we see is during that period, there were still, you know, regular challenges to the plastic industry and attempts to ban mostly particular products, but much less emphasis on plastics in general or many of the plastics that had been targeted in that earlier period. So a lot of, you know, after sort of 1996, 1997 or so, up until relatively recently, most efforts to ban plastic products really came down to plastic bag bans. You know, plastic bags were still one of those things that were, I think, most people kind of understood weren't recyclable. And so they also have a, you know, very visible role in the environment. We see plastic bags, you know, pretty routinely. And I don't know, they're just sort of one of those things that I think stands out in our daily lives as just sort of a crazy way to use these very valuable resources, right? We go to the grocery store and bring back, you know, 10 or 12 of these plastic bags that then never get used again. So a lot of the efforts in that interim period were, you know, I guess sort of a lot of the resistance to plastic really centered on plastic grocery bags. And the industry's response during that period was really mostly to try to include plastic bags into the plastic recycling myth. You know, that's the same time that we see much more widespread references to recycling plastic bags. You began to see all of these plastic bag drop-off containers start popping up at grocery stores and other you know, big establishments that use those bags. Basically, you know, a widespread effort to convince people that actually plastic bags had all of this value that couldn't be accomplished by other materials and that they too were widely recyclable. And in many cases, they were pretty successful. Again, kind of founding front groups. Some of those front groups even were basically involved with different plastics industry trade organizations. It really was a, you know, widespread connected effort, but they were reasonably successful.
Over the last 10 years, there has been renewed scrutiny and activism around plastic waste, especially as the public, as you mentioned earlier, has learned about microplastics contaminating our oceans and, you know, in the food that we eat, in our bodies. It now even appears that microplastics can cross the blood-brain barrier. So there's been a great deal of concern, I think, bubbling up once again. And also, at the same time, China stopped agreeing to be a dumping ground for U.S. plastics. So how has the plastics industry responded to this surge now of concern? You know, as you've been illustrating, there have been sort of periodic waves of concern, and then the plastic industry has been pretty successful in redirecting that concern, channeling into the, as you call it, the myth of plastic recycling. And yet I would say that the kinds of concerns that people have now are of, you know, a planet that is awash in plastics. How is the industry responding to this particular moment?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think with between the microplastics knowledge becoming more and more widespread, the visibility of things like ocean plastics, you know, the way that the plastic straw in the sea turtle's nose sort of captured people's attention in a way that plastic waste hadn't, at least for a long time. And China's national sword policy, I think a lot of people responded to the announcement of of China's policy that they wouldn't be accepting our plastic waste, with surprise that China had been accepting our plastic waste, right? We, I think the average person, me included in that, really kind of believed that most of our plastic waste that we were putting into the bin was getting recycled. And so seeing how much plastic waste was out in the environment and, you know, that we were trying to find ways to deal with all of this plastic waste really put a fine point on the fact that recycling wasn't working to the degree that we believed it was. And so around 2017, the industry began using the term advanced recycling. They created that term to refer to you know, a variety of technologies that have been known for a long time as chemical recycling. That includes processes like pyrolysis, gasification, methanolysis, etc. There are a wide variety of them. Basically, all of these technologies, these processes, have been around in different forms for decades. And the industry has been interested in using chemical recycling technologies to address plastic waste for a long time. And basically have consistently, you know, have consistently found that it didn't represent a viable solution. So these, you know, so-called advanced recycling technologies, they have a variety of problems. All, you know, each of the technologies are different, but in general, they still rely upon, you know, a very clean, uniform input, which is the biggest challenge of post-consumer plastic recycling, and you know, have many of the same limitations that mechanical recycling does. So, yeah, the industry has placed a significant emphasis on these technologies, presenting them as the, you know, sort of end-all, be-all solution to the plastic waste crisis, but has failed to show that they are actually scalable. You know, in our report, we trace the interest in these technologies back, you know, at least 50 years. As early as 1977, the plastics industry was claiming that pyrolysis, for example, was ready for plastic-to-plastic recycling at scale at that time. That's never been shown to be true, and the industry has spent decades sort of hoping that their that practice can catch up to what they're claiming, but it hasn't happened yet.
So in many ways, the story that you all have laid out in your report, The Fraud of Plastic Recycling, seems actually quite familiar. There have been a number of industries that have been involved in things that are harmful and have a long-standing track record of cover-ups and fraudulent claims and deception. You know, we've seen this with tobacco. Obviously, we've seen it with big oil. Given the parallels here, in terms of dealing with what the kind of situation that we find ourselves in, which is this world in which plastic is everywhere, the particles of plastic are in our salt shakers, that plastic waste is in our oceans, what do you think should be done? What would holding these companies responsible look like in terms of the extent of the harm?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have good models for corporate accountability. Unfortunately, it is not a unique story. It is actually remarkably familiar. I think what we see across a variety of different industries is that, these companies are willing to say whatever they need to say to keep producing their product, whatever the consequences. And I think that we have to figure out ways to, genuinely demand accountability for that. I think the tobacco opioid lawsuits provide a really good model for this plastics recycling fraud. I think it's very clear we have abundant evidence that the industry was actively deceiving people about the recyclability of plastic and using that deception to continue producing plastic, at an almost unimaginable scale, right? And they don't have any intention of stopping. It's not as if this is a problem that was, something that happened in the past that we have an answer to now. The industry is going to continue to expand production very dramatically over the coming decades unless there are genuine accountability measures taken. So I hope that we will see plastics recycling lawsuits in the same way that we've begun to see climate lawsuits, again, kind of following those models of tobacco and opioids and other industries that have known and lied about the impacts of their products. The California Attorney General's office actually launched an investigation into the fossil fuel company's role in this issue several years ago. And just the other day, Rob Bonta announced that that investigation will be concluding soon. So I'm hoping that there will be a case in California and that other cases will follow. But beyond that, beyond accountability, I think it's also just really vital that we reduce plastic production. I mean, ultimately, the industry was... actually helped kind of instill this idea of reduce, reuse, recycle into our brains. And I think that's how we should approach this. We should start with reduction. The reality is that we are producing, and by we, I mean the petrochemical industry, the reality is that they're producing far more plastic than needs to exist. They're producing plastic at almost an unimaginable scale. And again, just the vast majority of those products, especially disposable and single-use products, don't need to exist. So I think caps on production, limits to how much plastic can be produced, is a step that we have to take, and one that is widely supported. There are ongoing UN treaty negotiations right now. The vast majority of countries at those negotiations support caps on production, but that's unfortunately being held up by many of the countries that produce the most plastic, produce the most fossil fuels, including the United States.
Well, finally, often in the United States, when people look at the environmental crises, often things get compartmentalized into single issues. And as we see people organize around the climate crisis, do you feel like plastics should be considered as part of that crisis, as well as a crisis of their own, in that it's actually big oil that is involved in the production of plastics, and the production of plastics is being made from a fossil fuel?
I do. I think, in many ways, the issues are impossible to separate because they are, in many cases, the same companies, and it's based on the same fossil fuel products. So, one, the plastics should be viewed as part of the climate crisis because the production of plastics has enormous climate consequences, and because the industry's proposed solutions, like advanced recycling, will only exacerbate those climate impacts. Like I said, the companies are the same, the fossil fuel products are the same, and the companies, because of that, really view plastics as sort of their plan B. So as we succeed in shifting away from burning fossil fuels for energy, we are going to see expanded plastic production as the industry seeks to find another viable outlet for those fossil fuels that they're extracting. And so ultimately, I think the issues are sort of inseparable, and we have to look to solutions that address both problems simultaneously.
Davis, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Davis Allen is the lead author of the report, The Fraud of Plastic Recycling: How Big Oil and the Plastics Industry Deceived the Public for Decades and Caused the Plastic Waste Crisis. That report is out from the Center for Climate Integrity, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. Please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.